Good evening, everyone. If I have your attention, we'll go ahead and kick off for the evening. Welcome, everyone, to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. We run on the academic year, so that means we're kind of in the twilight of this year and working on our schedule for fall. And for those of you not familiar with us, although we've been doing more or less the same kind of programming for well over 30 years, we don't have a single paid staff person, never have. It's all volunteer labor. And I'm one of the volunteer board of directors. And we just try to present you guys as wide an array of viewpoints as we can so that you can come learn about them. And so our mission is not to try to push any particular viewpoint or worldview, but to allow you to come absorb all kinds of different perspectives. And business-wise, we do, although we're completely nonprofit, we do have some expenses, and so we ask for a $5 contribution toward our cost. And Dr. Alcag back there, if you didn't get a chance to pay him on the way in, you can pay him on the way out. And the food is on your own without Phoenix, but be sure and take care of your bill and tip your wait staff generously. They work hard. And how many are here for your first Dallas Philosophers Forum lecture? Okay, great. And there's a group here. I met, and remind me, because I was told that I forgot. What's the group?
The Northlake College Philosophy Club.
Northlake Club. Okay, excellent.
All right.
Appreciate your interest in us, and if Dr. Alcott didn't give you the student discount, there is a student discount, so you don't have to pay the $5 if you're a student.
We have some other students, too, some other
visitors. Okay, great. Well, welcome everybody. So we are kind of in our wind down for the year, but we've got one special event 2 weeks from today, and so it'll be same time but different place, slightly different format. This will be the second year now, consecutively, that we've presented Philosopher's Jeopardy. And what that consists of is we have a game called Classroom Jeopardy that has the little signaling devices and the electronic scoreboard and projects the grid with the categories and the answers to the categories on the screen. And we have three local institutions compete, which this year are going to be Southern Methodist University, University of Texas at Arlington, the defending champ, and University of Dallas. So they will be competing actually for cash prizes to the department. We award $300 for the first place team, $200 for the second place, and $100 for the third place. So nobody goes home empty-handed, and if you feel inclined to make a special contribution toward those gifts, that will be welcome. And we are not doing it here because this room isn't quite big enough for the crowd we got last year and hope to get again this year. So we are doing it at Unity of Dallas, which is 6525 Forest Lane, and it's pretty easy to find. It's between Hillcrest and Preston, and it's on the north side, about halfway in between. So if you're just kind of driving in the right lane going westbound, you're probably not going to miss it. Just come in the front door, and it's a big room to the right that we call Fellowship Hall. So we'll
I have some extra flyers for people who didn't get one about that. It's got the address, so pick up one.
What time is
7 o'clock.
Yeah, 7 o'clock. Yeah, 7 o'clock starts. So,
little
7 o'clock is what my program says. So make note of that. And hope to see y'all out there. It's usually a lot of fun, kind of to try to guess the answers, the questions to the answers, and watch the competition. So I think that's all of our business, so we can get on to the program for the evening. Whoops.
turn their stuff off.
Yeah. For some reason, just decided to go. Not green on me. I can project a little bit.
Too close.
Well, I will just project a little bit. I'm very pleased to welcome back to Dallas Philosophers Forum. By my recollection, this is his third time to present to us. A good friend of mine, Dr. Frank Romer, who's at Austin College up the road in Sherman, and he's in the political science department there, and has been there for 27 years, and has a lot of very successful progeny that have tutored under him, and he's going to be talking to us tonight on the topic of a thinker named Montesquieu. So let's give a warm welcome to Frank Romer.
Thank you very much for the invitation to return to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. I've greatly enjoyed my visits here previously. Can you hear me well enough? Is it loud enough? Okay. Well, the topic of this conversation will be about Montesquieu, whose dates were 1689 to 1755. So those of you with some familiarity with philosophy will see that his life overlapped somewhat with that of the father of the French Revolution, Rousseau, but Montesquieu is essentially a man of the previous generation and someone whom Rousseau considered a great genius. We will talk a little bit later about how these two differ in some very important respects. But Montesquieu is probably best noted to us Americans as the most influential writer, or at least the most quoted writer in political philosophy by both the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist in the debate over the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. Montesquieu is most famously known as a great defender of separation of powers as well as of Confederate government for the grouping of small republics in such a way as to take advantage of the organization of a large empire. while Montesquieu is best noted for those principles, that is separation of powers and for Confederacy, and while he can arguably be considered the most influential political philosopher of the 18th century, though Rousseau's fans would certainly disagree with that, I would say that most of those who've looked at Montesquieu have really not revealed very well what he is all about. And indeed, I think we can say that Montesquieu has appeared, particularly his great masterpiece, The Spirit of the Laws, appears as a great mystery and quandary to most of those who have looked at it. It's a book about this thick. It's essentially divided into six parts. Each one of those of about 100 pages in length, written in an epigrammatic style, and rather difficult. The pieces are easy to understand, but putting the pieces together is a very, very great challenge. Now, Montesquieu first gained literary fame by the publication of his work, The Persian Letters, in 1721. And this work made him kind of a household name, an intellectual celebrity in France, but it was the publication of The Spirit of the Laws in 1748 which really, really brought to him the status of being probably the greatest political philosopher of the 18th century. But I really want to focus the first half of this talk on the least recognized of his three great works. The Persian Letters comes in 1721, The Spirit of the Laws in 1748. But intermediate between them was a work that is rather little known except by those like me who love to study 18th century political philosophy, and that is a work called The Considerations on the Causes of the Greatness of the Romans and Their Decline. Now this work I consider to be, and for those of you young people, and I want to especially thank you for being here this evening. It's great to see you here, and I teach so many people like you. And I have some, you know, business cards with me, too. If you want to continue a dialogue after this via email, you're certainly welcome to do so, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. But if you really want to understand Montesquieu, I don't recommend starting with the spirit of the laws. It's huge, it's difficult, it's discouraging. The place to start with is with his considerations on the causes of the greatness of the Romans and their decline. A small book that really reveals the method of his political science. That this political science of Montesquieu's is really the unifying thread of his masterpiece, The Spirit of the Laws. So I would say study the considerations first, and this is sort of the key to unlocking where Montesquieu is going with The Spirit of the Laws. Now, Montesquieu's approach to politics was a conscious attempt to discover the principles and methods of a science of politics, which necessitated, in Montesquieu's mind, a break from classical, Christian, and even early modern political philosophy. I'll try to make clear why that's the case. Now, in his considerations, Montesquieu presents a philosophic history that searches for the causes, and this is very important, so if you were reading this, underline it, the causes of both the greatness of the Romans and their decline. Now, what at first appears in this work, The Considerations, as an episodic treatment of the growth of Rome under the kings, the rise to greatness under the Republic, the degradation under the emperors, and finally the collapse of Rome's divided parts when it was divided into the Eastern Empire and the Western Empire, what we see, this is actually an inquiry using history as the laboratory of empirical observation into the motive springs of Rome's existence, revealing a teleological evolution of a rude, rustic people into the dominant power of the ancient Mediterranean world. Now, let me explain this. This sounds contradictory, perhaps, teleological evolution, because when we think of evolutionary theory, we see it as the exact opposite of any kind of notion of a teleological approach or a teleological meaning or rational logos, whether it's divine or natural, in the world. And so what Montesquieu is trying to get at is the origins, and some people at this table were talking about their interest in origins or beginnings. For Montesquieu, the origins, or think of an acorn growing into an oak, for Montesquieu, the origins of a political order is very, very important to understand, because he sees something in the origins, particularly of Rome, that propelled it in the direction that would eventually occur. Now, it's interesting, too, when I use the term teleological evolution, because Montesquieu, from everything I can tell, is not a religious man, so he sees no divine logos, no divine purpose or reason behind the world, and yet he thinks there is a rationality, there is an order, there is an endedness to the direction of Rome's development once it had a certain type of beginning. Now, Montesquieu's historical inquiry, and again, his historical approach is more of what we might call a philosophical history, because Montesquieu's history is designed to provide the foundations of an empirical political science, one that is not based on abstract theories so much as it begins with the empirical data of a particular people. And so his story of Rome, his considerations, reveals the story of a people who were from their very beginning, as he says, destined for war with universal conquest, their object. Rome's rise to grandeur was not the result of fortuitous causes, but the result of a distinctive Roman spirit, a spirit infused with pride that drove the Romans to a relentless assault on all the hostile forces surrounding them. Now again, the word spirit here is very important, as obviously that will be the key word in his masterpiece, The Spirit of the Laws. there was a certain spirit that was Roman, something distinctive that was Roman from the very origins. And that spirit itself had a certain directional growth when placed in the surroundings that were about Rome. The pride of warlike kings began Rome's external conquest, and this pride was increased by the people's hatred of kingly rule, which was stoked by the patricians of Rome, and by the people's love of liberty. And these two things, their pride combined with their rebellion against kings, their love of liberty, these things gave to the whole people a militant spirit. So the spirit of Rome from its very early stage was a militant kind of spirit. For a people of such violent pride, virtue, virtus in the Roman or Latin language, became understood as courage and the martial art, the only art worthy of real men. And just think of our word virtue etymologically coming from the Latin virtus, and from that word, or virtus, you could pronounce it that way, we get the virile, virility, are connected with the very Roman understanding of what virtue was. This proud and violent virtue drove Rome's expansionist conquest, led by a seemingly inexhaustible supply of great men, drawn to public service not only by duty to the res publica, literally the public thing, but even more for the coveted award of a triumph, which Montesquieu proclaims was the main cause of the greatness the city attained. And the triumph was when the conquering heroes would come back, there would be a gigantic parade, and they would parade their captives and the wealth they had captured, and everything would be in that parade. Surrounded by fierce and hostile peoples, the Romans were forced to practice their virtue in constant warfare until war became, as Montesquieu says, a mere meditation and peace and exercise. In other words, war was easier for them than peace. It's as though they were so practiced a football team that when they actually went into the game was decided before they went into it. And it was just merely an exercise to go out against their enemies. Rome's institutions, particularly the consulate and the Senate, were lures to the ambition of patricians, and these institutions wisely channeled the internal divisions of the city into external wars. Rome was made to expand. And so it's very famous in Rome, this tension between the patricians and the plebeians. But what Montesquieu is telling us, and here we see the influence of Machiavelli on Montesquieu, but the tensions between the patricians and the plebeians, rather than the Romans sort of snuffing that out, they channeled that militant anger externally. And so what we see is that this kind of internal Roman anger was focused outwards in the wars, the constant wars against their enemies. And the Romans being constantly at war but with different enemies, and this is how they united both a very prudent foreign policy to their military spirit. The Romans were always at war but with different enemies, and that way the Romans were always perfectly practiced at war, and none of their enemies had a chance to develop the military art or to learn how to fight the Romans very well. Now, Rome's institutions, the teleology of this expansion, Rome was made to expand, the teleology of this expansion, guided by ruthless foreign policy of divide et impera, literally divide and rule, or divide and conquer, would propel Rome from a village of poor farmers living in log cabins to the glory of the Mediterranean world. Paradoxically, it was the achievement of its very goal, universal conquest under the great general Pompey, that brought about Rome's ruin. So how is it that Montesquieu can think that the accomplishment of Rome's basic spirit, which was that of martial conquest, that that itself, its very, you might say its very peak, its very pinnacle, was itself that which brought about its ruin? Here Montesquieu uncovers four scientific causes of Rome's decline. First, Roman virtue had been grounded in an equal division of lands. And the conquering Roman soldiers, when they experienced the wealth of Syria, began to experience a luxury that enervated their virtue. Secondly, as the Romans were making these last great conquests, the extremes of wealth and poverty were making themselves known in the city of Rome itself. Third, Rome's expansionary success brought to Rome a whole array of foreign peoples who did not see Rome with the same eyes or act with the same spirit. Spirit, again, being very important here. And fourth, geography itself placed limits on Rome. As the soldiers of Rome became essentially the soldiers of Marius and Sulla, of Pompey and Caesar, as these armies became so far distant from Rome that the soldiers became completely dependent on their generals. And so they were no longer Roman soldiers, but the soldiers of these particular commanders. And so that's the key thing about Caesar crossing the Rubicon when he comes from the Gallic Wars back into Italy. The practice was to lay down one's arms, and of course Caesar crosses the Rubicon with the soldiers armed, which meant the soldiers were now Caesar's soldiers and not Roman citizen soldiers. Now Rome's greatness, however, did not die immediately with the Republic. The Republic was dead at the point of these great triumphs. But what we can say is that the spirit of Caesar triumphed before the body of Caesar. And this new Roman spirit, the senatorial assassins of Caesar, could not kill. Now this is a critical point that Montesquieu makes very powerfully. Shakespeare does it so well. If any of you are familiar with Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, Montesquieu, who's writing after Shakespeare, makes the same point. And if you think of the ghost of Caesar in Shakespeare's plays, it comes back. Montesquieu has kind of a similar point to this. And it's as though the assassins of Caesar, they wanted to kill the spirit of Caesar. At least that's what Marcus Brutus wanted to do. But they ended up killing the body of Caesar without killing the spirit of Caesar. And Shakespeare brings this out by showing the rabble of the crowd as a bunch of rabble, at the very corrupt rabble at the very beginning of his play. Well, Montesquieu basically teaches us the same thing. The spirit of Caesar had already triumphed before the body of Caesar, and essentially the Republic was dead because Roman virtue was near dead. Roman greatness, however, did not die immediately with the Republic. The glory of Rome reached its peak under Augustus, as Montesquieu says, the name that flattery gave Octavius. But the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, proved to be a corrosive peace. With no wars, there was no need for Romans. And this takes us back to the Roman spirit, and it takes us back to this idea of the acorn and the oak. For Montesquieu, the Roman spirit was, from the beginning, a militant, militaristic, conquering spirit. The virtue of the Romans, their understanding of what virtue meant, was manly courage in battle. Only when there was war, constant war, could Roman virtue express itself outwardly. This was a violent, destructive kind of virtue. And when it could not express itself externally, it begins to express itself more internally. Again, with no wars, there was no need for Romans. The harsh virtues of Roman citizens became the harsh vices of cruel emperors. Rome's greatness had been the wisely directed expression of what the political philosopher Thomas Hobbes of the 17th century had discovered in the nature of man. The desire for power after power that ceases only in death. And what Montesquieu is telling us is that that really is the correct understanding of what at least the Roman spirit was, is the desire for power after power that was unleashed by Roman policy in a very constructive way throughout the Republic. Once that Republic had grown to its full size and could no longer expand, there was no way to outer that violent virtue anymore, and it turns inward in a very, very destructive way. When geography prevented further expansion, Rome was corrupted and its violence turned inward. As the body of Rome was emptied of its life-giving spirit, the body decayed and died. And so again, it's this, what I'm trying to get at here is to use the considerations on the causes of the greatness of the Romans and their decline to show you what Montesquieu means by the spirit of the laws in his masterpiece. Of course, the Roman spirit would be very different from the spirit of other regimes, although we're going to see some parallel here with the French or Frankish regime in just a second. Now, Montesquieu's scientific investigation into the causes of Rome's rise and fall becomes the key to understanding his masterpiece, The Spirit of the Laws, and the political conservatism, and this is kind of the theme of what I wanted to drive out in this talk, the political conservatism that emerges from his bold intellectual project, which in his own words has begotten a child without a mother. And this is a point that he makes at the beginning of The Spirit of the Laws, that he has begotten a child without a mother. What does he mean by that? What he means is, and maybe this is a little bit of his ego showing off, but essentially his intellectual project is so novel that it is a departure from everything that everyone else has done. Those who have studied the relationship between Machiavelli and Montesquieu say, well, he leans more on Machiavelli than he's willing to admit, but a real departure from classical political philosophy, a real departure from Christian political thought, a real departure from the early modern liberalism of Hobbes and Locke. Now, The Spirit of the Laws is a massive project divided into six parts, each of roughly 100 pages in length. The Spirit of the Laws has frustrated scholars with its daunting labyrinth of opaque subjects addressed in epigrammatic style, layering ambiguity upon ambiguity. And Montesquieu's writing I find very delightful to read. It's just charming. It just sticks with you, and you can remember so many of the statements. But they're layered, so one interesting statement after another, but how do you put them all together to get the big picture? This is one of the... He seems to just jump from this to this to this, and he writes in this style. It's as though, you know, they're utterances of the Delphic oracle that could be interpreted in about 18 different ways to meet any kind of circumstance. What is he really getting at with these very obscure comments? Yet the imposing maze of the work's design and expression was the result, as D'Alembert, the French philosopher, said in a very insightful remark, of a purposeful obscurity. So D'Alembert is telling us that Montesquieu purposefully made what he was saying rather obscure. We are challenged and invited to investigate, to inquire, much as the scientist who perhaps has a hunch about what the truth of a thing may be, but we are, you might say, invited to begin a search and inquiry into labyrinthine passages. And by the way, this is the way Montesquieu's work developed, because somebody asked me earlier here at the table, well, wasn't he an aristocrat in the French government? Yes, he was the president of one of the parlements, a kind of judicial administrative body in a rather rural sort of area of France. But this job gave to him access to an enormous number of medieval documents. And Montesquieu spent some 20 years poring over these documents. And it was out of this very deep research into the medieval origins of the French nation that he developed much of his political theory. So what he's telling us is that his theory is developed now, but its beginnings were very, very obscure. And he went through many meandering, winding paths to get there. Now, part one of The Spirit of the Laws reveals a writer who has abandoned classical political philosophy and its search for the best regime, who has abandoned Christian natural law, and has abandoned modern social contract theory for a comparative historical investigation of actual regimes and the spirit giving them life. So he's abandoning all kinds of universal concepts. He's abandoning all kinds of abstract thought to look concretely at the regimes of his own time and of ancient times that he has empirical evidence about. Montesquieu's search was not for the human good considered universally and abstractly, but for the variety of human goods, informing the spirit of different peoples, ancient and modern, East and West. An approach to politics that would inform, by the way, the conservative liberalism of Edmund Burke and William Blackstone, who were both heavily influenced by Montesquieu. And so Burke and Blackstone are very influential in the second half of the 18th century. I'll try to get back to some of that influence in a moment. For Montesquieu, Burke, and Blackstone, history replaces nature at the center of their political philosophy. So again, there's a movement away from, you can see this in Burke's reflections on the revolution in France, as he's criticizing Rousseau and the French revolutionaries for their abstract theory. And he claims that they, or he says that they claim to be for the rights of man. They claim to be for justice, but they are only for some type of abstract humanity, and they are not dealing with a concrete humanity that the statesman must be concerned with. Where Rousseau begins with, man is born free, but is everywhere in chains, that opening of Rousseau's social contract, which notice, if man is born free and is everywhere in chains, every existing political order is unjust and revolution is warranted. Very different from Montesquieu, who begins with particular men and women in specific circumstances. So Montesquieu would never say man is born free in some broad sense like this. He's dealing with particular people in particular times in particular places. Where Rousseau looks to a Lycurgan moment when unjust polities could be constituted anew, as Lycurgus, the founder of Sparta, did in that city, Montesquieu distrusts the revolutionary longing for pure principles to reform complex reality. And here is one of the huge differences between Montesquieu and Rousseau, I promise. Rousseau is someone who is motivated by the notion that human nature is malleable, that human beings are perfectible, and that, you know, change the circumstances, change the environment, you can really bring about a new type of human being and a society based upon a general will. Montesquieu is very distrustful about any kind of radical revolutionary change. Montesquieu is very, very doubtful about any projects to reform human beings to bring about human perfection. As Montesquieu says, virtue itself hath need of limits. And as Montesquieu says in another place, it is easier to find men who are virtuous than to find men who are wise. And Montesquieu's wisdom is one that I would say is highly tolerant of human imperfection. All right. Now lurking for Montesquieu in the background of something like Rousseau's idea or those who want some type of revolutionary perfection is a kind of cruel despotism unsympathetic to real human desires and unmindful of the limits of human reason. This is again exactly Burke's criticism of the French revolutionaries, that there was something cruel and violent even in their attempts to bring about justice. Now, the connection here between Montesquieu's political science and his political conservatism is best seen perhaps in his comparative study of two great French kings, St. Louis and the great Sun King, Louis XIV. Now, Louis XIV, it's interesting, was an admirer of Oriental despotism, even as the Ottoman Empire was becoming corrupt. And as Montesquieu shows, going all the way back to his first great work, The Persian Letters, in 1721, he continues this in the 1748 work, The Spirit of the Laws, Louis XIV, while seemingly the Sun King, had weakened the two props of the French monarchy, the nobility and the church. In doing so, Louis XIV, in the attempt to increase his kingly power, struck a deadly blow to the heart of the French Constitution. And we have to understand what Montesquieu means by a constitution, because it helps us to understand what he means by the spirit of the laws. A constitution is not just like we think, our written constitution. A constitution for Montesquieu means what constitutes this people over here, the French people, as opposed to the German people, the English people, the American people. What is it that constitutes them? And what constitutes them is a distinctive spirit. Now, Montesquieu's painstaking study of medieval documents had revealed to him that the great spiritual power of the church and the martial power of the nobility, these were the two great props of the French Constitution. Now, this French Constitution owed its origin, and this is where we get some parallels between Montesquieu and Blackstone, but the French Constitution owed its origins to a spirit traceable back to the violent virtues of the Germanic tribes who overthrew the Roman Empire and to the spiritual power of the Roman Church. Now, the reason why I say there's some parallel here with Blackstone, if you study that great four-volume work, and this is a painful thing to read through, Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, but you can see there, as Blackstone shows us the common law of England, if you read this work with discretion, you'll see that he thinks that the common law of England may not really have been English at all, but is traceable back essentially to the Norman French conquerors, and then from there back to Germanic law. And so the English law may not be English at all. Now, Charlemagne, from Montesquieu's perspective, was the greatest of the Frankish kings, who made maintained order and expanded the Frankish Empire by protecting the Roman Church, all the while keeping his violent nobles occupied by expansionist wars. There's a parallel there with Machiavelli's treatment of Ferdinand of Aragon, Ferdinand the Catholic, and his ability to unite Spain under religious guise. In an empire so constituted, cruelty and injustice, according to Montesquieu, were necessary. Now let's pause over that one. That's very disturbing. I remember when giving a paper on Montesquieu up in Ottawa, Canada, about 2 years ago, and I was reading a paper on the considerations, and the panel chair was a Canadian woman, very, very nice lady, and after I finished, she just said, "I'm in total shock." She said, "I'm just too Canadian to listen to this." So some of the tough realism of Montesquieu on the Romans, she just could not handle. But notice that cruelty and injustice were necessary. They were an essential part of the French Constitution. Now, why was that the case? As Montesquieu writes, the Franks, that Germanic people, tolerated murderous kings because they were murderous. They were not struck by the injustice and pillaging of their kings because they too plundered and were unjust. In other words, these were a marauding kind of people, and essentially Charlemagne knew this, and their other kings knew this. While Montesquieu viewed Charlemagne as the greatest of Frankish kings, the unity of the Frankish kingdom depended on the force of his genius, and unraveled soon after his death. Actually, it's within two generations after his death. Now, within two generations, Montesquieu says, the Carolingian Empire was a spectacle worthy of pity. How did it go from this grandeur under Charlemagne to a spectacle worthy of pity in two generations? The metamorphosis of the Frankish constitution into feudalism occurred under Hugh Capet as the nobles were awarded irrevocable fiefs. Now, this is a very technical kind of issue, and a couple of things here that we need to mention. First of all, Montesquieu uses the term metamorphosis many, many times. Those of you who maybe have studied Latin at some point or are interested in classical literature immediately think metamorphosis, Ovid. Montesquieu constantly quotes Ovid's Metamorphoses in his Spirit of the Laws. And metamorphosis, rather than stability, is for Montesquieu at really the center, you might say, of things. Now, The other thing I'm pointing out here, the decline of the Frankish Empire is connected here with this issue of fiefs, which becomes a huge issue in Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England. I don't know if David, being an expert here on dirt, is an expert on Blackstone or not, but let me explain what we mean here. By sometimes you hear the word fiefs, sometimes the word fee is used, and they mean the same thing. Essentially, it was originally a grant from a king who was essentially the warlord of warlords, the biggest thug of a group of thugs, marauding thugs, who made a grant of land to his underlords to reward them for the military service they provided to. And then there was something also called sub-infeudation and like, and where they would then make awards to their followers. Well, these fiefs were originally at the will of the king, who was the chief warlord of a group of warlords. And this is all out of this Germanic history and part of the Germanic constitution. But what we see is, and this was true in England as well as in France, the nobles didn't so much care for having to go off on military service at the beckoning of kings and to be sort of not quite the king's slave, but something like that. And they didn't like the fact that these lands could not be under their control to hand down to their children. And so they worked very, very hard to make these fiefs into something more permanent. And so, I don't know how many lawyers there are, but anyone who has bought a home, and when you see a contract and your purchase of your home is made in fee simple, what we see is that is very much in conflict with this original notion of fief, which was an irrevocable kind of fief. Now, which was a revocable fief, and fee simple then is does away with that ability of someone else to take that away. Now, Montesquieu's frequent references to Ovid's Metamorphoses points to a fundamental principle of Montesquieu's political science, the continuous reality of motion. Here you see his departure particularly from any notion of, you know, Socratic forms or ideas, any notion of Christian medieval thought of there being essences or substances. If you think of Ovid's Metamorphoses, creatures are turning from one creature into another creature. And this is Montesquieu's view of the continuous motion of reality. In Montesquieu's Ovidian world of change, universe is always temporary and tending to chaos. Metamorphosis, not permanence, is reality. And here we get the connection with his conservatism. You would think that that would lead to some type of existentialism and or some type of Protagorean notion that man is the measure of all things. But in one sense that's true, of Montesquieu, in another sense not. In the absence of any divine logos or natural logos, only human art guided by human wisdom can provide form and a degree of permanence. And I think if you read Burke with discretion, if you read Blackstone with discretion, I think you see there the reason for their conservatism, and I think they take this from Montesquieu, that if the world is a world of Ovidian metamorphosis, always tending from order to chaos, then what is it that takes the place of, you might say, the absent guiding hand of divine logos, of divine reason? For Montesquieu, it is human art, the statesman's art. And so the statesman's art is a kind of godlike art. Since disorder and chaos are so likely to occur and order is so difficult to establish and maintain, this is the reason for Montesquieu's conservatism. So his conservatism is not based on any kind of dogmatic religion. It's not based on any kind of notion of static Socratic forms or ideas. It's based actually on a sort of radical modernist notion of the constant motion and impermanence of all things. Chaos is constantly intruding into order and trying to dominate order. Montesquieu's model of the prudent and artful legislator is St. Louis, who followed the advice of the god Apollo to his son Phaeton. Steer the celestial chariot neither too high nor too low, always keeping to the middle course. St. Louis, with the wisdom of the true legislator, adapted specific legislative reforms to the Constitution of France as a whole. In other words, we're back to the spirit issue. In other words, any particular law needs to be made consistent with what the overall spirit of the French Constitution was. But that was a French Constitution that St. Louis was trying to alter, but he did it in a very gentle and incremental kind of way. But an incremental kind of way consistent with, you might say, with the telos of where he was trying to take the spirit of the French regime. St. Louis avoiding a radical masterpiece of legislation, that is a comprehensive reform of feudalism, followed the practice of Solon and gave his people, Solon is the great lawgiver of Athens, the practice of Solon and gave his people not the best laws, but the best laws they could endure. By the gradual reintroduction of Roman law, as opposed to Germanic feudal law, much of it by insinuation and not by force, St. Louis set in motion a reform of the feudal constitution that would be the foundation of French greatness and prosperity for three centuries. Now, I know I need to wrap things up. There are many, many more things to say, but I'll try to wrap it up now, and then we can open things up for questions. Montesquieu's empirical and historical science provides a revelation of an ever-changing universe of forms changing into other forms as Ovid had presented. In this Heraclitean world of motion, Heraclitus, the one who said, you can never step into the same river twice, a complexity of forces generates the unfolding in history of a variety of human ends, often clashing within and across civilizations. And so there's not just one end of human life, one good of human life. There are many goods for Montesquieu. But those many goods may not be compatible with this particular constitution or that particular constitution. In this human predicament, Montesquieu finds no simple or final solution. The best the realist can do, and this is part of his conservatism is that of a realist comfortable with human imperfection, tolerant of human imperfection. The best the realist can do is to begin like the good astronomer and find the sun's position and navigate from there. In other words, not to start with what is the best regime, not to start with, as Rousseau would do, what is the just and the unjust, but how are things ordered in this time and in this place. The same approach, I think, if you study Burke carefully, you'll see that Edmund Burke took the same approach, I think, of William Blackstone in his commentaries on the laws of England. So that's all I have to say right now, and I'll certainly take whatever questions you may have.
So for Montesquieu, when a new in a group, when a new idea forms, a new, like, would he believe in the evolution, like in a new spirit? So over time, if you have a spirit like the Romans, and then it starts to fall apart, and they get a new idea, would he believe that that is the evolution of a new spirit, or the true creation of a new spirit because of the new idea?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And so, you know, to sort of rephrase it just a little bit, can a spirit, one spirit, turn into a different spirit, I think is one of the questions. And then the other question is, would that change be the result just of an evolution, or could it be the result of a certain creation, a creative moment that would bring about that change? Now, let me try to answer that from Montesquieu's perspective. I would say this, and let's just sort of follow him with his Romans and then go and take a look at his Franks and the French. The Roman thing lasted from going back to the legendary
founders of Romulus and Remus, all the way up to the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 5th century AD. Now, as Montesquieu teaches us in the Considerations, and I just didn't have time to go into all of this, what's happening is, as the Roman Empire is becoming corrupted and more in the 3rd century, in the 4th century, and then in the 5th century, what is happening is a new spirit is being born and is taking over, and we know what that spirit is, the spirit of Christianity is taking over. So you have a very, very different spirit that is being introduced into the Roman Empire, and one, by the way, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. And one that Montesquieu finds quite incompatible with the spirit of the Romans. Now, I think if you read the Considerations carefully, you'll see that while the Western Roman Empire collapsed, really with not any role of Christianity in that, was other forces that led to that, particularly the invasions of the various Germanic peoples that destroyed the Romans. And as Montesquieu and Machiavelli both teach us, the Romans losing that Roman military spirit when they stopped operating by their own arms, as Machiavelli and Montesquieu both say, and they began to hire foreign mercenaries. When Roman virtue is too big a burden for Romans, that's when you know the spirit's dead. And as Montesquieu says, they were defeated by Germanic peoples who had imbibed the Roman spirit to a great extent. Now, what we see is then the Western Roman Empire, it seems to me, collapses for reasons not really connected with Christianity. But the Eastern Roman Empire would live on in Constantinople, Byzantium, the Byzantine Empire, into the 15th century. And there, Montesquieu traces that collapse has a lot more to do with the spirit of Christianity, which did have an enervating effect on the ancient militaristic spirit of the Romans. So where did the spirit of Christianity come from? Well, you all know that as well as I do, and that is not just a result of evolution, that is a result of, you could say, a creative moment, whether it is divine or human, however you want to look at it, it's still more of a creative moment. But then that spirit, once planted in a creative way, it has a certain, I think Montesquieu would say, it begins to evolve in its kind of logical direction, and one incompatible with the ancient Romans. So then, when we get the Frankish Empire under Charlemagne, part of Charlemagne's brilliance is to say, I'm not going to operate according to, you know, what the most just thing is, or just what my greatest power is. I'm going to look at what are the real forces I have to deal with. And one real force he had to deal with was, you know, he's the biggest warlord of warlords. He has got all of these other men who live by war that he has to reward. Okay? So that's one reality. But the other reality was down there in Rome, a new Rome with a new spirit, and that was that of the Christian church. And so that was something else that was a reality. And so balancing those two things, think of how different that was and what genius it took to balance those forces. And then when you get into the person of St. Louis, someone who becomes a saint in the Catholic Church, you know, go to New Orleans and you see the St. Louis Cathedral and named after him. But here you see someone who brought about a significant change in the Frankish regime, all right? And so there you do get a combination of a kind of evolution, but also some creative moments that are allowed in there. But notice how creative. St. Louis doesn't try to radically change. It's a sort of, you might say, smoothing out the edges here and there and setting into place some things that he tries to make as compatible with the existing French Constitution as possible. And Montesquieu thinks that is a way of being like Phaeton, of having to steer, you know, neither the highest route or the lowest route, but in between, not doing what's perfectly just, but doing what is possible. And that, from Montesquieu, is a sign of wisdom. To not try for perfection, because human beings are not perfect. And reason is not the only thing that we live by. Tradition is very, very important. And different people different traditions. And so for Montesquieu, so I think your question is a really, really terrific question. So there are creative moments there, but I think Montesquieu is warning statesmen, be wary of being overly creative. Your question was one that just really, really got me going.
Okay, yeah, you said at the beginning that Montesquieu encouraged the separation of powers when he got into the United States Constitution, and I think that, but you didn't elaborate on that.
Yeah.
And was he advocating that in the books he wrote, or was that the sort of a consequence that the American founding fathers picked up, or what?
Okay, several things. Another good question. I just mentioned that because my point was essentially, and I realized I was trying to cover a lot of ground very, very quickly. Usually when you read kind of introductory books in political theory and political science, they'll talk about Montesquieu's contribution to political science was his doctrine of separation of powers, and then they move on to somebody else. And maybe they'll talk about the Anti-Federalists, particularly were interested in his teaching on separation of powers, but also the Anti-Federalists would have said that you can only have a republic over a small territorial area, which had come from classical political theory, and Montesquieu has shown us the only way that you can construct a large imperial-sized regime is through a confederacy of small republics. So those were the two things the American founders really took from Montesquieu, and that's only from one part of Montesquieu's work, and I would call it almost a minor footnote in Montesquieu compared to this larger type of political science that I'm trying to point out here, which leads him to a conservatism so in opposition to Rousseau, who follows him in kind of the next generation. So in terms of separation of powers, Montesquieu would argue for that in certain kinds of constitutions, as in England. Of course, the United States comes about just a little bit later. But he would say that in certain places that could work, and he actually defends that as part of the French Constitution that St. Louis created. And by the way, Machiavelli, it may surprise us, but Machiavelli also in The Prince notes that this is one of the great things about French constitutions, which makes the survival of France in Machiavelli's view more likely than the survival of other regimes. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so you talk of conservatism, but isn't it really more like pragmatism than trying to keep things the same way?
Well, Montesquieu doesn't say you have to keep things exactly the same way because circumstances may require you to make changes because, as he is very clear, motion is really the only consistent thing. So anyone who wants to totally stand still is likely to be destroyed. But you want to maintain certain foundational things that may be very important to this particular constitution as opposed to that particular one. So Montesquieu's conservatism is not a conservatism that is a religious conservatism. It's not a conservatism also looking to any kind of notion of natural law or any abstract notion of natural right or any kind of rigid, let's say, legal interpretations, people who are sort of rigid originalist today or something like that. His conservatism is none of that. His conservatism is about being cautious about radical revolutionary changes that move in the direction of the perfection of something. And perfectionism is something that he doesn't think is likely to happen in human affairs.
Thank you.
And if I can interject, another thing his conservatism would be libertarianism, correct?
Well, again, libertarianism could be seen to be an abstraction, too. And I would say that, Montesquieu would say that a libertarian, if you just want to act on pure principles, let's say like Ron Paul, and there may be Ron Paul fans here, and I think David and I both heard Ron Paul speak back in the fall. I know I was at that summer's event. But, libertarianism can become dogma just as Marxism can be dogma or Catholicism can be dogma. And so here you, let's say somebody like Montesquieu is living in a nation that's a Catholic nation. Montesquieu himself, I think, is an atheist. But he would say Catholicism is important. But his view of Catholicism is certainly no dogmatic Catholicism. It's, you know, let's be careful about damaging this, because it will damage more than just that. And so libertarianism, Montesquieu believes that freedom is actually very important to human happiness. This is not something I was able to get into, because this is a huge issue, particularly in the Persian letters, the issue of happiness. It's in, by the way, it's in the Romans, considerations of the Romans too, because one thing he points out, Roman virtue was an unhappy virtue. And one of the reasons it was unhappy is it was so unnatural to be so devoted to the res publica, literally the public thing, and so little concern for one's private happiness. You have the situation in law, by the way, that he notes, where Roman statesmen, Roman, you know, aristocrats, give up their citizenship as Romans, essentially to protect the daughters that they loved, because under the Roman laws, the daughters could not inherit any property, and once they were dead, their daughters might be in a destitute situation, but if they were no longer citizens, they could do different things with their property for their daughters. And so Montesquieu notes that there's something very unnatural and harsh even about that Roman virtue. Now, he thought that Roman virtue was essential to the Roman constitution, but not necessarily productive of human happiness. And if you read the Persian letters, you'll see it's all about how different social arrangements lead to human unhappiness. And yet, Montesquieu thinks there's only so much one can do to remedy the problems of the human condition on the level of politics.
Okay. I have a two-part question for you. Now, the first one, he seemed to realize change is the only constant, but at the same time, he was a little bit conservative as far as limiting change when it comes to being, like you described it, as force evolution. Mm-hmm. He was anti-change in that way. But my other question has to do with, what do you think is the spirit of America? Because we seem to be following a little bit of the Roman model, not as a sense of the warfare, like, you know, traditional battle on the battlefield, but economic warfare. We seem to be trying to dominate every market with our companies and our financial prowess. Are we a little bit like the Roman in that type of spirit?
Okay, well, here I would just say, you know, a good work to read here of someone who is very influenced by Montesquieu's approach would be Tocqueville. And Tocqueville would show that what constitutes America, and he has a similar view of what constitutes a people, it's its spirit. And the American spirit, as Tocqueville teaches us, is a spirit of adventurous conquest, but not military conquest, but commercial business conquest. So that's kind of the acorn, the seed that Tocqueville perceives that's going to lead, actually, the United States, he predicts, and you have to remember when Tocqueville was writing The Democracy in America in the 1830s and 1840s, the United States was the third world developing country at that time. I mean, this was a backwater place, particularly on the frontier. And so what we see is that Tocqueville is saying that, and he predicts the United States will be one of the great superpowers. He predicts Russia would be the other great superpower, and he's predicting that in the 1830s and 1840s. And so he sees that as part of what constitutes the United States, that what is really part of its vitality, what, and this is a very Montesquieuan model that he's using. You know, let's not talk about the best regime, but what is this, what is the sort of mainspring of this people? And what he notes is a kind of restiveness in the soul of Americans, that they have this joyless quest for joy, that acquisitiveness is what they are all about. And, you know, they get this house and this car, you know, and they've got that, and that's not good enough. They have to have the bigger house and the better car. But what does that do? That creates all these little dynamos, these little productor, they're producers, consumers, but you tap into all these little generators of energy, and you get a high voltage regime out of that, and the result you're going to get from that is that you're going to get a country that is going to be dominant. Now, of course, the argument could be made now. One of the arguments that you see is a little bit different from yours, it would say, well, isn't China moving in the direction, isn't the trajectory of China to become the dominant country? And they do it with a state form of capitalism rather than the more individualist kind of model of the United States. And so, and even many students of international relations theory like John Mearsheimer, a contemporary realist, would argue that the collision that's coming in the future, unless we just simply surrender, is going to be not the United States with the Middle East or with Russia, it's going to be the U.S. and China, and that there's just no way of avoiding that, and that East Asia, you know, will be, around Korea, will probably be in that area, the point of conflict. So I would say that, you know, this kind of conquering spirit, that's part of the American spirit from the beginning. And notice as Tocqueville says, you know, the United States conquered from sea to shining sea. Those conquests were not all just ask the American Indians, you know, African American slaves. So there's been much injustice in that story. But nonetheless, it was that spirit that brought about that domination and has brought about a significant part of the world order that exists. Now, is that world order perfectly just or anything close to it? If we brought Montesquieu and Tocqueville into the room, they'd say, of course it's not even remotely close to perfectly just. But then the problem is, if you lose that order, what do you replace it with? And that's where the conservatism of Montesquieu would come in, and the conservatism of Tocqueville would come in. And neither one of them is a saber-rattling nationalist or anything like that. But both of them are saying that in politics, if things can get worse, they probably will. And you better be very, very careful about looking for change. I know I haven't answered all of your questions.
I think you've
answered most of my question, and I wanted, you know, to get your comparison and contrast with Rome and the United States through Montesquieu. You know, this what you said about the citizen army of Rome. You know, it went and morphed from the Republic to a professional army that did not allegiance to the city, but to the generals. But still, and there were good and bad emperors, and some very, very bad. But the strength of the Roman regime lasted 600 or 700 years was its laws. You know, you had and you had some division. Even the fiction of the autocratic emperor, he still had the Senate, you know, as a fiction, so that there was some separation. And you did have magistrates who you know, took care of the laws, and everybody knew that they were under Roman law. You had a Pax Romana, even though you had that army to protect the borders. If you didn't have that army, you wouldn't have the Pax Romana. So I think the United States, you know, we started out in log cabins as a crude and you know, an impressive people too, and now we are the power of the world. And we kind of look on ourselves as kind of morally superior, just like the Romans did. You know, the Romans were at war all the time, but they never thought that they were in an unjust or immoral war. They always blamed it on, you know, their enemy. And we have been at war constantly for a century, our country, and we're still at war. We are a very warlike country, but without that strong army, you know, how can we protect our moral hegemony?
Okay.
You know, today we seem to be in kind of a defensive, you know, almost embarrassed, you know, we're embarrassed by our power. We should be one of the citizens of the world instead of the first citizen, you know. So I want you to tell to me what Montesquieu would say about American hegemony now.
Okay, first of all, there are two ways of looking at it. One is in terms of, let's say, political military influence, and the second is looking at it in terms of a moral hegemony. I think Montesquieu and Tocqueville both would be very suspect about any kind of theories of moral hegemony. In fact, one of the great lessons of Montesquieu is to bring us respect for other peoples and cultures by his comparative historical method. And for us to understand other peoples as they understand themselves, I think that's very important. So I think Montesquieu and I think Tocqueville too would not view the United States as some type of moral hegemon, and I think they might warn a bit about that kind of thinking because it may lead to an unrealistic analysis of one's place in the world, and also it could lead one to do things to other peoples that would be very imprudent as well as unjust because we don't understand it. But in terms of political military power, I think that they're both very much hard-nosed realists. Again, what is the alternative? And this is how I connect these two very good questions. What is the alternative to an American order? I don't see one out there. There either is no alternative, or it is one that is far worse than anything that we would bring with all the imperfections that we bring with us.
Right. Hi. I was wondering, how would you view the Eurozone as it has developed, where you have a very, they're trying to build a European identity versus what they have, what they currently have now, which is a French, German, Scandinavian, and how do you think it would be something, this European identity would flourish, or do you think it would fall to the natural identity of the people there?
Well, look at the United Kingdom right now. Now, you have on the one hand in the United Kingdom, you know, which is not completely a part of the European Union, but, you know, sort of one foot in, one foot out, but a strong movement away from that in the United Kingdom. And at the same time, you see a strong movement for independence in Scotland, as well as for greater autonomy for Wales. And I mean, this would undo centuries of unification in terms of the United Kingdom in Britain alone. you know, from what I can see is, I mean, look at the Greece problem right now. It's just one of the problems. I honestly don't see how this European Union thing will work. I'm not an expert on European politics, but I just don't see how that is going to work. Because to make it work at all, the wealthier countries, more advanced countries of Germany and France, and the Netherlands and Scandinavian countries, will have to essentially be able to regulate the economic policies of Greece and of Italy and of Spain and of Portugal. And this, and in doing this, this is also going to drain an enormous amount of wealth, as it already is, out of those wealthier European countries. So that's one point. That's mostly on the economic side of things. The other side of things, look, I mean, what is really the biggest threat to the European Union right now? One is that disintegrating force, but the other thing is, look at Putin's actions in terms of Ukraine right now. Now, if Europe were completely united and willing to answer that problem, I would be more optimistic about some type of European Union. But Europe doesn't seem to be able to deal with this huge strategic threat to it that is potentially coming from Russia. And so if they can't even deal with that, I don't see where the European Union is going to go in the future. So I'm very pessimistic about that. And I tend to think that the forces of nationalism and even of localism are very, very powerful right now, so I'm not high on the prospects of the European Union.
Hello. I'm going to go back to the spirit. I'm sorry. My brain's still foggy. I've been up since 4 in the morning. When you were thinking back, I think last time I read Caesar, it was 6 years ago, but the Julius Caesar part, I think, one time I remember the line is that he died as a martyr, therefore he shall live eternity. And then as soon as he said, he just taunted them, and then I thought of House of Cards. There was a scene in there that, said, I won't kill you, but I will destroy your spirit, so when men think of you, they won't cherish your memory. Everything will be gone. So to destroy natural content and try to figure out the source of the symbol then? For right now, for Scotland, sorry. Wait a minute. For Scotland, they're focusing on their main villain is the European, the main English country, because they have as soon as they try to get independence, 2 weeks later, they had a tax race. And that became a huge sign again. And then recently, they just won all the political seats for Scotland, were all independent leaders. And then for Wales, the same thing happened. Because all of the political leaders for their state became independent because they saw this surge of identity within themselves. So I think how is to destroy... I'm so sorry.
It's two questions.
Well, one question you asked had to deal with this question of killing someone's spirit and connected with Julius Caesar. And another question that you're asking has to do with this sort of disintegrating force of localism versus a more nationalistic kind of spirit. Let me go after the first question, the question of killing spirit. It's very interesting here, and I think I'm going to talk about Shakespeare a second, but I think it's applicable here to Montesquieu as well. It's not just Shakespeare, but you can look at Plutarch, it's in Plutarch as well. Marcus Brutus, one of the senatorial assassins of Caesar, wanted to kill the spirit of Caesar, but not the body of Caesar. All right. The other conspirators, and this is what in Shakespeare's play, Antony says at the end, that Brutus was the noblest Roman of them all. He's the only one who was not motivated by personal rancor towards Caesar. The other ones wanted to kill the body of Caesar. What is it that, and this is what connects us back to Montesquieu, what is it that Brutus was trying to do, and is what Cassius plays upon, his name Brutus, which takes you back to Junius Brutus, the founder of the Roman Republic. He's saying, you, Brutus, your name is connected with Roman Republican liberty. You need to be one of the assassins of Caesar, essentially. And so what Marcus Brutus wanted to do was kill the spirit of Caesar, because he's not interested in killing Caesar as a person, but he wants to return Rome to its ancient virtue. Now, what Shakespeare's play teaches us very well, what Montesquieu teaches us very well, is that really that tragedy is not just a tragedy of Julius Caesar, it's a tragedy of Marcus Brutus, because he failed to see things really in Montesquieu's more conservative terms. And what he failed to see was this. The Romans were so corrupt that ancient virtue was too great a burden. The spirit was changing, and Caesar may have been the best thing that they had going for them in those changed, those metamorphized circumstances. And so what we see is that Brutus is one of those who is looking for that kind of Lycurgan moment, or looking for that kind of Rousseauan type of revolution that will be more complete. And what Montesquieu is saying to us is, that's just terribly, terribly unwise. Things have evolved to such an extent that one spirit is being replaced by another. You have realism. Political realism means noting that. Now, I'm not sure what to do with this unraveling of the United Kingdom moving into the spirit of localism here. But one of the things that I think is a huge issue here for the United States and all of the Western democratic countries, based on what I would call a political theory of modern liberalism, based on government, being based on the consent of the government, dedicated to individual rights, and governed essentially by a secular form of government, that to what extent does that political theory of modern liberalism inspire them? To what extent does that create a one out of a many? See, which strikes me that politics is that art of making an unum out of a pluribus, a one out of a many. And this is what Montesquieu is teaching us in a way. This is a very delicate thing, in that unity
always be tending to collapse into a chaos. In other words, what's going to make your centripetal forces greater that's making things cohere and making them greater than centrifugal forces pulling things apart? Now, whales standing alone in the modern world, I mean, what sense does this make? Even Scotland, given a great history, true, but standing apart, you know, and this weakens, of course, Scotland's independence. If you go back in English history, this is always the weak point for England, because the foreign power could always ally with the Scots against the English. So just look at the threat even to Scotland that introduces. So I'm not quite sure, but one thing it may suggest to me is, you know, what is going on in the United Kingdom? Is it just this Scottish tradition that could be part of it, or is there a loss of identity? And there are many people from England who live abroad now who don't want to go back to England. And that may suggest, I mean, modern liberal society may have a problem inspiring people in some way, but I'm not sure that I can really answer your question.
Got time for one more. Okay, over here.
Hi, my name is Aaron. I have a question. How would Montesquieu's conservative nature fit into modern dichotomies of emerging bodies of thought, such as emerging bodies of thought that require global cooperation infused with pragmatic principles that can be actually viable in a capitalist global economy? And the emerging pools of thought I'm talking about are immigration policy, environmental sustainability and social justice, international human rights, and computerizing technological global charters.
Okay. Well, first of all, in terms of the computer issue, he would say that's a reality and that's not going away. That would be one thing he would say. But in other things like international human rights, you know, I think Montesquieu would say that's an abstraction. And that is something that's not going to be enforceable. And the same standards are perhaps not even desirable from one nation to the next nation, because they won't fit into the constitution of those nations. So what I'm saying is Montesquieu, I think, would be very, very doubtful of some international order which is really an international order to the extent that you will have one series of laws or one political theory or one economic theory that fits everywhere. That's just not going to happen. And so that would move us back more in that particularity, that localism issue. Because what he would say is that's not respecting these people over there in the South American country and these people over there in the African country and these people in Asian country. They have cultures, see, that have been that are thousands of years old in many cases. And so we have to realize those kinds of differences. Now, when that gets into immigration policy, see, that's the problem the Romans had, where you have many foreign peoples come in, and they don't see Rome with the same eyes. This is, I think, one of the problems that we don't feel it as much. We feel it here, but we don't feel it as much because we are so large, and we are kind of diverse for a good while. But in countries as small as Britain, more and more in the Scandinavian countries, you're seeing France pretty recently a serious problem like this. And so I think you're going to see in those smaller countries in particular that immigration issue will be a more tense issue than it will be for us, but it will be for us as well. And I think Montesquieu would say, well, you know, you can have some immigration, but there's not going to be any kind of purely abstract way of looking at this. It's going to be a prudential question. You can have some immigration, and that's going to be desirable, but there's just open immigration? No, not a good idea. All right, and no kind of blanket principle. That's a kind of dogmatism that he would distrust. And there are going to be certain countries that can have more immigration, others can have less immigration. I think it's going to be the case that the bigger the territorial area, probably the more immigration that you could have. But a lot of it depends on other cultural factors. Now, I know we can't just go on and on and on, but this, you're on to an interesting point. Think of the connection here between television, radio, the internet, so communications generally, and the growing tensions between what we loosely call the West, and particularly Islamic countries. Now, Montesquieu would say you need to learn to respect those countries and what they are. You need to understand them. That's what his comparative study is all about. We need to understand them. We need to have respect for them. But, you know, the more you bring things closer, as our age is necessarily going to do, that is not going to lead to some very, very serious problems. And it's not going to be very easy to make things, in Saudi Arabia, work very well with the way, let's say, France is or the way the United States is. And so the explosions that we're seeing in Middle Eastern areas today, I think Montesquieu would say, that doesn't surprise me one bit. And the existence of TV, radio, internet, it's probably going to make that for a long, long time, maybe, you know, a couple hundred years or more, a very, very difficult problem. And they're not going to be solved by international agreements. They're not going to be solved by international law. By the way, they're not going to be solved. They're just going to stay there as problems that can be made somewhat better or perhaps a lot worse. And I thank you.